Thank you, Kelly. I guess I did not do what you asked me to do. I apologize. Okay, so jumping in then to a discussion of how specifically the information that we've learned might be, either in specific or general ways, applied to improve guardian ad litem representation or refine it in some way. I would like to just call your attention to the outline that you were provided in the email and the different roles that we have listed for guardian ad litem. And essentially, you know, this is modeled after the way that we, you know, the statutory mandate that we have in terms of information gatherer, reporter to the court, being the child's advocate, and then in addition, being the stable person in the child's life and the child's advocate in the community, which I think is something that's more evolved over time, but is central to our mission. So one of the first questions that I wanted to ask to the group is to get your feedback on whether or not trying to break the issue out in this way makes sense to you, or should we try to do it a different way? So what I mean again by that is, you know, my thought was we could think about the four webinars that we had and maybe identify some more topics that we want to have presented to us in the future. But should we, if we want to sit back and reflect on how am I incorporating trauma-informed principles, how am I incorporating what science is telling us about child development, is the best way to do that by looking at our different roles with the child, or does someone have another way that we might try to apply what we've learned to the way we advocate for children?
Deborah, this is Bethany Barber in Orlando. I very much liked the list that you have. My only request would be for the advocacy section, if perhaps we could break that out into advocacy subject areas, because, for instance, educational advocacy may look very different than, you know, advocacy for socialization, depending on the elements of trauma that a child has experienced. So that would be my only request or my only feedback.
That's a great point, Bethany. That makes sense to me. I think you're right that there are a number of dimensions of the advocacy. Including, you know, by topic area, as you just said, but there are also some functional pieces in terms of, you know, there are, it seems, trauma-informed principles that we should be applying to how we're talking in court, but also trauma-informed principles about how we judge and involve a child's participation in court. I think your suggestion to break down the advocacy piece is a good one. Who else has a reaction?
This is John Jurekis down in Fort Myers. A lot of this material, some of this I was familiar with in my own career in mental health, and you know, it can be pretty dense in a lot of what we were hearing about brain development and, you know, the effects that all this trauma is having on these children at such a young age. I'm just thinking we got to try to find a way to lay this out for the volunteers and incorporate it into, you know, into our trainings and have some of these same presentations, because I think just to understand the impact. And then I think as people are going to advocate, a lot of times I think volunteers are trying to advocate for services. And, you know, my experience has been that our children in care, the issues are so much more profound than community mental health, that hopefully at some point you can carve services out that are designed for our children. where they have, you know, something along the lines of a fact team or a, you know, a kids cat team things, but it's designed specifically for this population with people who are employed that really know all of this, because it is very different than just general community mental health.
I'd like to piggyback on that. This is Marcia Hilty. I think that certainly making our volunteers more aware of these issues is of tremendous importance, especially since we hear the language all too often that a child blew this placement or didn't respond to treatment, and consequently they get the message that they're failures. So I think this is critical information for our volunteers to have, but I also think it's critical information for staff, especially when we're advocating in the courtroom, that we request more information on who will be providing treatment, what are their credentials, are they certified in addressing this population. My experience has been that many of our children are assigned to interns. And I don't have anything against interns because I was there many moons ago. But this is just, you know, our children are in a critical juncture in their lives, and to assign them to interns to me is unacceptable. And I've intervened on numerous occasions in regard to this matter. But the problem is that so many of our providers are Medicaid funded providers, and therefore are employed through our community mental health centers and so on and so forth. And that's the training ground for interns. So I think bringing the issue to ACA's attention is another area that we might want to consider, as well as the Department of Children and Families, who works with our providers of mental health and substance abuse services.
Hey, Deborah, this is Lori Blade.
Yeah, go ahead, Lori, please.
Yeah, I want to jump in just for a second. Thank you, John and Marcia. I agree with everything that you just said. And I can certainly help with ACA and with DCF. I mean, that's the bigger, you know, systems issue, and that's not going to be, you know, fixed overnight. But I think one of the opportunities that we have, and in staffing kids with you all since coming to GAL, one of the things that I realize is happening, and I think we could get much better at it, but I also think we need to give ourselves credit for doing it, is we are pushing for trauma-informed care services and approach to serving kids one kid at a time with the dependency case managers, with the people that are serving kids, with residential treatment providers. And so I think if our GALs, our CAMs, our attorneys, you know, all of our staff really kind of understand this, we can also serve as a resource and an education for people that are treating our kids, especially those, you know, people right out of college who may not have a whole lot of experience and working with kids. You know, we can certainly advocate, especially the ones that have the more complex needs. They need somebody who is who has experience, who knows what they're doing. But we can also serve as a resource or educating the system on how they should be serving these kids. And we do that one kid at a time.
So kind of understanding this might be a little different in terms of what a GAL might need to know, and the level of what they need to know versus a CAM, and what their role is versus an attorney and what they need to know.
Agreed.
Yes. Marty, and I wanted to piggyback on everything else. I totally agree with everything that's being said from the provider standpoint. We also need to make sure we're thinking about our foster parents, our relative caregivers, our non-relative caregivers, because when you talk about blowing placements and all of that, these caregivers are not provided with this type of training either. I know I'm in Circuit 8, they're just starting to do some trauma-informed care training as part of like foster parent training. And then you look at the relative and non-relative caregivers, and they're not even getting that level of training. As well as the caseworkers a lot of them don't get this. They come out of programs that are not social work or even family science, and some of them that even come out of those don't have the trauma-informed approach. You know, thinking about judges, that kind of stuff as well. You know, CPIs. There's so much education that needs to be done on this.
I think you guys are all, this is fabulous feedback, and I think we're, you know, really all sort of exemplifying how guardian ad litem can be an advocate in the community for the child and, you know, be the help push down the first domino. You know, one of the notes that I'm just sort of making regarding training is, you know, the need for cross training, the need to get to other stakeholders. You know, I think that in addition to looking at different audiences that we're going to train, you know, I think it was Lori that said we need to make sure that it's targeted to people's specific function. Whether you're the volunteer, you need to know a different collection of, you know, strategies and principles than you might if you're an attorney. Some may be universal. The question that I wanted to ask, though, is if Lee Merritt, if you don't mind, I know that OSCA has done a fair amount of this work with trauma-informed principles. And to Judge Tepper, it all seems very intuitive and very integrated in what she's doing. So from a branch perspective, since that's the big umbrella that we're all working under, how do you see this need to have another change agent? You know, maybe it will be guardian ad litem, and what should we know about what's already been done as we consider taking this on in some way or shape or form?
I think that some, like you said, Judge Teppers out there have educated themselves, and so they run their courtroom in a trauma responsive, a trauma informed way. There's other judges and other courts that don't. And so what we've been doing is getting the word out in our messaging regarding trauma informed care, of trauma responsiveness to our dependency court judges. So, I mean, it's not that there's a judge out there that hasn't heard of this or is not aware of it, but some are either practicing it or they're not, or some are somewhere in between. You know, there's the ones like, you know, with the therapy, they have the therapy dogs in court, et cetera, and they're actually, you know, working toward ensuring that their courts are run in that way, in that manner, and sort of a strive to be more like a Judge Tepper's. But, I mean, I couldn't tell you exactly which judges are and aren't, but I know that, you know, for us, it's something we talk about, you know, regularly, and we have a lot of information on our website for our family court judges. And so I guess what we do is point them to that pretty regularly. We actually created a curriculum to be trauma responsive courts for the courts to do. Is sort of a do-it-yourself thing, but we obviously will help with TA and stuff. But that's kind of where, I mean, I couldn't tell you like what percentage of them, you know, are practicing or are aware, but even though it's been going on for a while, we would think, wouldn't everybody understand this by now? The truth is we have new folks coming in, new judges, new stakeholders, new people all the time, the turnover. So it's something you have to talk about on an ongoing basis.
This is Eric. I'm ready to jump in. I am the supervisor up here for the Second Circuit. And like Lee was saying, you know, we are great and we're blessed because we have Judge Schustrom, who's our chief judge, and he's also our dependency judge here in Tallahassee and Leon. And he is well informed, and he goes to a lot of the trainings. He goes to the ECC, the 0-3. He goes to the summit. He goes to the GAL symposium, and he embraces it and he uses it and he uses the terms. The same thing with Magistrate Pedroso and Judge Jill Walker out in Wakulla. But then we have the flip side where we have judges who aren't as involved and aren't as informed and are new, and it's trying to get them caught up. So we have half of our circuit who's all about it, and then we have half of our circuit It's not that they're against it. They just don't have the information, and it's trying to get them all on the same page.
Hi, this is Natalie from the 11th Circuit down in Miami. I think because of that, we part of the advocating role that the guardians are going to be having is to educate those judges in those courtrooms that don't understand it or haven't been taught trauma-informed courts yet. So I think that might be something to look at in our advocating section that Deborah mentioned in one of our roles. Is maybe a subset is educating the courts who don't have trauma knowledge yet.
So I was thinking earlier, this is Lee again, I was thinking earlier when some folks were talking that one of the things that could happen, so if we educate all our GALs, for example, and they're aware of trauma, they understand, they know how to respond, they're ready to go, and then they go into a courtroom or they go visit a foster home, and they realize that those folks aren't thinking like what they're thinking, and they're understanding, you know, what the children experience or what the parents are experiencing based on what they've learned, then they could be the person or the agent, I guess, to sort of identify some of those gaps and some places where some work needs to be done.
Yes. Yes, I think, you know, I think for this piece, there's going to be, you know, a big picture stakeholder thing. You know, we are going to be doing some presentations on trauma at the Specialized Advocacy Seminar Symposium in May. And, you know, there may be some opportunities for cross-training. But then in addition, the other parallel track is, you know, in court, you know, for individual children, how do you make sure, you know, the assessments that you're asking for will not only, you know, assess trauma, but be able to make recommendations to appropriate services? How do you explain, you know, in a motion that there are factors related to trauma that should influence the judge's decision? So I think we'll be working on those two different tracks.
This is Alan Abramowitz. I also think we have the opportunity, if we get this certification for child advocate managers, to infuse how our managers work with the volunteers. Because when you have 13,000 volunteers, we'd be training every day. I mean, but we do have a constant being our best interest attorneys and our child advocate managers to basically set the tone and how our volunteers understand where we're going with this initiative. And the good thing is, you know, it looks like it's in House and Senate budget that we are going to get this certification. And as we the curriculum gets rolled out, that it is infused with trauma-informed advocacy.
And that's actually a really great segment to, a great segue to talk a little bit about, you know, Guardian Ad Litem as a trauma-informed organization. You know, we've been talking specifically about our advocacy and our mission, and the two sort of different aspects, again, the individual child, and then also, you know, the system and the community that the child finds himself or herself in, and how we're advocating it within that. But we also have the aspects of the trauma-informed organization, which is not only about how we train our people and what our people are qualified to do, but how we deal with trauma, you know, for our employees and, you know, in our facilities and that sort of thing. So since Alan brought that up, if you don't mind, I did want to ask whether anyone on the phone, and I think I know the answer to this, has been incorporating some of the principles of becoming a trauma-informed organization within their GAL programs locally.
Deborah, this is Marty. I've been doing trauma trainings for the 8th Circuit, and I'm actually scheduled to do one for the 5th Circuit. I think it's later this month.
So Marty, what can you just like maybe give us the highlights of what that looks like? Is it more about general principles, or is it advocacy, or is it more about staff and dealing with secondary trauma? What does that look like?
Yes, so it starts out just kind of with a brief intro of adverse childhood experiences and what that means, because we hear it thrown around so much, and what that converts to in adulthood outside of protective factors. And then I move on and talk about what trauma does to the developing brain of the child. And I take it from the approach of in utero, before that child's even born, what can happen to the brain. And even, you know, kind of throughout the life, what happens if trauma goes untreated. And then looking to at attachment and how that affects the child's behaviors. And then moving on to giving an overview of trust-based relational intervention, TBRI, as a way to connect with kids and to work with kids who've experienced trauma, such as, you know, behavioral matching, modeling, you know, offering choices, giving the child a voice, helping the child to not just be safe, but to actually have felt safety, to feel safe, and things that they can actually model for parents as well.
Great.
I've done this at the DCF Child Protection Summit. I was just in Tallahassee a couple weeks ago at the Instilling Hope Conference for Peace for Big Bend. I do the FAPA conferences, the national and state ones. I'm working with the Florida Sheriff Youth Ranches right now. I was at a SIP facility 2 weeks ago training their staff on TBRI. So I go all over the state, and so far I've been able to do most of this for free.
Wow, that's wonderful. So jumping off from where Marty is, I'm thinking that at some point we will probably need to break off a smaller work group and talk specifically about how we would tackle this, you know, in-house, the logistics of the training piece. That would fall under Frank Prado, Prado, and that's something that I think maybe we can get select people from the work group to either participate in themselves or make recommendations on something. But it seems to me that you know, there's the logistical part of it, and then there's, and forgive me, I'm just sort of thinking out loud here, you know, implementing this across the entire Guardian Ad Litem program could be classified, everything that we could do would be classified under training, if that makes sense.
Right.
But I think, you know, I think that I may just put a pin in that for right now and maybe call a few of you offline and get some ideas. And as I said, get Frank and the training team involved in terms of how that would be implemented. So there's that operational aspect of it. If we stop there and set that aside for a second, we had planned on having Dr. Gillen provide her TBRI presentation to this group, subject to scheduling. But I wanted to ask people, as a group that over the next couple of months will be asked to come up with specific recommendations on how we implement this and what substantive areas we think need to be prioritized as they relate to guardian ad litem advocacy, are there other topics or other speakers that you all feel like you would want to have, you know, do a presentation for us? Are there any holes that you think we need to fill in, or things that we have learned about that we would want to shore up?
Deborah, I have a maybe a suggestion or a question, and I don't know if this is needed or not, so I'll start that way. But given the physical effects and medical problems that result from trauma, I wonder if it would be helpful to hear from a physician on whether there needs to be a difference in like primary care for kids who have been impacted by trauma. I'm not sure if it extends to that much, but it would be helpful to get somebody's perspective that understands the medical portion of it.
Yeah, I think I actually had a thought along the same lines, you know, when I was writing down the different roles that we have and under advocacy, given the fact that what we've learned is that by the time you get to four ACEs or more, you have statistically, you know, significant higher probabilities of certain medical and mental and emotional conditions. You know, at what point are we have a trigger to say, okay, you know, knowing the circumstances and the background of this child, I'm going to, you know, ask for something additional, ask for something different that is of, you know, medical or mental health or something like that. So there may be, we probably do need more information on that. And I guess we'll just need to decide whether that information should come to this group or whether we would want it to be more specifically incorporated into training of, you know, one of our constituents, whether it's attorneys or CAMs, like that.
Deborah,
who else?
Marty.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead, Marty.
I mean, thinking about like ADHD, we have a ton of our kids who get diagnosed with that, but there are so many symptoms of ADHD and trauma that are overlapped. And a lot of your pediatricians don't go ahead to try to kind of peel off those onion levels to get at what it really is. So, you know, just thinking of that same, but like the University of Florida, literally Shands just now started screening for ACEs within the last few months.
Wow.
You've got a lot of folks who they will talk about ACEs and all of that, but they don't truly understand the trauma, even from the physician standpoint.
And this is Marcia again. I was just reading some articles in the field of social work and psychology, and the number of clinicians who are qualified to approach this as trauma-informed clinicians is really low. It was astounding to me reading these articles. So, you know, again, I worry that it's the blind leading the blind and that we need to be elevate our awareness of interventions and what is appropriate, what should be expected for our kids.
Yeah, that's a good point. And, you know, and I recall, too, Judge Tepper making the comment that, you know, you can even get into a situation where you believe you've identified a provider that has people qualified to assess trauma on there, but then you get the referral and you realize that you don't have the individual who does have the certification. You have someone else who's just working there. So, you know, I think as an organization, you know, again, as the child advocate in the community, understanding who has the appropriate certifications, you know, will be an important first step and maybe a deceptively simple one that we'll have to go ahead and try and identify and then make sure that, you know, the people we've identified are in fact the certified professionals we think they are.
This is John again. The other thing we've run into, so we're often getting some pretty heavy med recommendations, and then when we look at them, they're coming from ARNPs. And we've had a couple times where we've asked for second opinions from a psychiatrist. A couple of the providers, they'll have like satellite offices where they don't even have a psychiatrist there. And we're getting some very young kids with, you know, recommendations with medication that is just, you know, very concerning.
That is, yes. Go ahead.
This is Lee. I'm sorry to just jump in, but when I'm listening, I'm sort of listening from my guardian ad litem volunteer hat, with that on, to see how can I use what I'm hearing from you all and what we're trying to do in my day to day work with the families. And so I do hear a lot of great information that I feel that is important for the staff to have the training on, and then see what out of that, see what the GAL volunteers, might need beyond that, I guess, because it's too much. A lot of that will be way too much information for them. But all they need to understand, the basics that they need to understand is something I'm kind of trying to focus on. And I know that, the goal is for GAL to be, trauma-informed as an organization, which I completely appreciate. But there's so much involved in that. So I don't know. I guess I'm just sort of bringing it back to the GAL for a moment.
I think a lot of the frustration that I get from the volunteers is, a lot of these folks really go out of their way to educate themselves and do research, and then they come in with recommendations, and we often have to tell them, that doesn't exist. That service isn't there. It's not available. So maybe in some way we can provide, what is there? What providers in each of our areas are there and what they do, and get it so that they're making recommendations in court that actually can happen. Because I do hear that frustration a lot when they'll get the information about what a kid needs and we just don't have the service to accommodate it. Get a lot of assessments but not as much services to apply to it.
I appreciate your questions, Lee. I think that just like with medications, we don't expect our volunteers to be medical professionals. Mm-hmm. What we do expect is that they will act as a prudent parent might, and ask the right questions. And the higher level of knowledge to me needs to be provided to our CAMs and to our attorneys. That's my position on that. I don't think that we can expect our volunteers to grasp this. I mean, most of us on this call are professionals, I don't consider myself to be an expert, though I have some understanding of this.
Hi, this is Natalie again. In addition to thinking about how we can train both the guardian, the volunteers, and the staff about dealing, advocating in a trauma-informed way, I think part of that, especially for the volunteers, should also include how does it impact their interaction with the parents, who we are now learning are also traumatized themselves. And that was part of what I think Judge Tepper also recognized, and she looked at it both in interacting with the kids and with the parents, and treating trauma and being trauma-informed in a holistic way. So how would it affect our guardians? And maybe we can give them some training on specifically working with the parents as well.
Good idea.
I agree. And, the other thing that, this is sort of an issue identification piece. I think Natalie's is a little bit different in terms of effective communication and understanding what you're seeing when you are interacting with parents who may have a number of ACEs themselves. But I do wonder if we are going to prioritize, we're going to have to prioritize. We cannot absorb all of this and put it down to every person. It's not doable. It's not efficient. It's, for a variety, it's just not wise. But with the volunteers, it seems to me that we probably need to educate them on the piece about resilience, since in terms of our multidisciplinary team, they are the ones who are in that role, in the stable, constant person in the child's life role. And it would seem to me that issue identification would be one big piece of any training that we give to the volunteers, but the building resilience piece would also be something that, you know, maybe they get more of that than maybe you would give to an attorney, sort of thing. I don't know that you necessarily would give the attorney less, but we haven't talked a lot about the building resilience piece. And I'm just wondering whether the group thinks that's something that we would want to hear more about. Dr. Gillen, maybe you can talk about whether that's something that, if you are able to do a TBRI presentation, you know, do you feel like that might be adequately covered in that? Or, you know, do we think that we would want to get another speaker on that particular topic? What do you guys think?
This is Marty. I think you may want somebody else to cover resiliency. I mean, I can cover it, but I'm by no means an expert on it. TBRI is going to be more about parenting. And, you know, even as our work as a guardian ad litem volunteer from that aspect. And then, I'm also the foster and adoptive mom as well, too. But, you know, thinking about it from that parenting perspective. And I didn't add this earlier, but helping folks understand what is normal development for a child. Even if you got a 3-year-old, in absence of any trauma, they're not logical little beings, right? But I think sometimes folks expect too much out of some of our little kids, and you throw trauma on it. And you may have a 14-year-old who's age 14, but developmentally they're a 7. Emotionally, they're about a 3.5 if they've experienced trauma. So it'll get at more of that kind of stuff and strategies for working with kids.
Okay. Well, that I think that's a really important piece. We focused almost exclusively on discussion of trauma today. And given our time constraints, I don't think that, you know, we'll have an opportunity to talk a little bit more about the child development piece. But as we move forward, I think we'll be going back and forth because we did have some presentations, particularly I think it was in December with Chad Sdam and those folks who talked about, you know, what are you seeing in the younger kids that's different than the school age kids, and what can you expect from, you know, teens generally in terms of cognitive ability and the ability to appreciate, you know, consequences long term, that sort of thing. And then, as you're saying, Dr. Gillen, how that all can change dramatically once you overlay trauma on it. And just having our people be able to understand what they're seeing. So I know we kept this to an hour, and I feel like we could just talk for days with all the different things that were presented to us and the ways that we need to move forward and start applying it to training and standards and practices. And what I think we will probably do is maybe start having conference calls like this a little more often, and then select webinars as that will inform our work, maybe break out into some smaller work groups. One of the things, though, that has been brought to our attention is that there are some immediate needs in terms of addressing trauma and being trauma-informed right now. I think perhaps being able to identify the resources in the communities is something that we can do concurrently with our work. I'll talk to Alan offline about how we might be able to start making available some information on who's credentialed and where they are, so that our people who are already understanding these issues have a little bit easier of a time getting the resources that they need. The other thing that was identified as an immediate need is the fact that as our people are learning about trauma, and now they have children who they're representing come to them, you know, the guardian ad litem is often the first person who is talking to these kids after removal, or maybe not talking to them, but explaining to them what happened. And so, as I mentioned earlier, I asked Lori Blades if she would be kind enough to develop something that we might be able to use in those circumstances. So we've been talking generally about what we've learned and how we'll apply it. This is sort of, you know, one illustration of specifically how we might develop something. So if you don't mind, I'd like to kind of switch gears from the general to the specific. And hopefully people had an opportunity to look over what Lori prepared. I would like to have Lori kind of explain what she did and how she did it and how she thinks it can be applied, and then maybe give you guys just an open forum to provide some feedback and reaction, and then we'll give everybody a couple more days to provide any more structured feedback via email. We'll prompt you with a reminder to get your comments in. But Lori, if you're still on, would you mind just going over what you've developed and how the group can give us feedback on that?
Sure, I can do that real quick. So what Deborah asked me to do was to kind of put together something that addresses how you engage and interact with the child who's just been removed. And so there's not a lot of research or information out there specific to this. There's a lot of information about trauma, but not specific to the event of removal as trauma. But there are some. And so the first page is really kind of the why, what's behind it, how trauma impacts children in general, and then how investigation and removal is also a traumatic event on top of all of that. And then it goes on to talk about what a traumatic experience might look like for a child at a different age. There's also a link in here in terms of the impact of trauma on children at different ages. So that traumatic experience and what it looks like at a different age is sort of specific to kind of the event of removal. So it's a child who has a history of trauma, but in addition to that, they have just been through an investigation. Who knows what that looked like? And then they were actually removed into out-of-home care. And then the last part of it is... I took this from a resource. So the University of Portland did a literature review and then focus groups with people who worked in child welfare. So protective investigators, attorneys, people who were working with kids shortly after removal, foster parents, to come up with some strategies that they could use to not only avoid re-traumatizing a child who's just been removed, but how to interact and engage them and build a relationship in a trauma-informed way. So that's where all of those sort of tips, practice tips came from. And that's pretty much it. I referenced the training that we have already established in our child, our academy. And that's pretty much it. So I don't know how this format might work for people. When I was doing this, I kind of put my GAL volunteer hat on and thought, okay, if I was a new GAL, or if I was meeting a child for the first time and I was fairly new and I wasn't really sure how to go about this, and I had some questions about how I might engage and interact and build a relationship with that child, having something that was very kind of brief, succinct, that had some practice tips that I could pull up and say, okay, I'm meeting a child in a couple days. Let me pull something up and give me some ideas on how I might want to plan ahead if I had any concerns about it or I wasn't really sure how to go about it. So that's kind of how I saw this. It's something that's very specific that somebody could pull up and kind of get their hands on pretty easily to kind of help them. And I think the TBRI, there may be a point at some point where we could incorporate some of that into here, but this is just what I found and what's out there so far. So, Deborah, I don't know if you want to give folks a little bit of time to kind of take a look at this, to kind of think about how we might use it, incorporate it into practice, and then give them a time frame to give us some feedback on it.
Yes, that sounds perfect. What we'll probably do is just recirculate the document as an attachment to an email and give everybody, you know, maybe a week or something, a time certain, to provide formal feedback. But I did just want to give people a moment on the phone to talk about, you know, whether there are any revisions or additions or anything that occurred to you as you looked through it on a first glance, or ideas on how it might be presented format-wise, either as a person who might actually use the tool or a person who might distribute the tool. Does anyone have any feedback they want to give us?
This is Eric Emery. Looking at page 5, something that jumped out at me, it's not necessarily about tweaking this form. I really appreciate that this was done, and I think it's going to be a great tool. But that jumped out at me because I get asked these questions all the time. What should they say? How should they answer? And I think that it'll be good that we'll be training them on when we're answering these, we need to kind of use that trauma-informed approach. But since we know these same questions are going to be asked over and over and over again, if maybe we can come up with almost not a standard answer with, you know, no attachment to the child behind it, but just a broad strokes kind of answer that they can give the child and then go from there, adapt to the individual circumstance of that child. But when they say, you know, why can't I see my parents, we should have kind of a template trauma-informed answer that they can start that discussion with the child on. And all of these questions are great. And that's what jumped out at me is if we can come up with trauma-informed, take all the information and start the conversation with the child with that approach and using that language, then we can go from there. And, you know, we don't have to give them a narrative to say, but just kind of give them a template answer.
Okay, thank you, Eric. That's a good, I see what you're saying. And I think there are, you know, in terms of trauma-informed principles, you know, making sure that whatever language we're using is not making promises we can't keep or, you know, noting that it needs to be developmentally appropriate, you know, maybe we can look at trying to incorporate some of those things in. Does anyone else have some thoughts either on format, on how you'd use this, on how you might distribute it?
Hey, Deborah, it's Marty. Under the communication strategies, there's lots of good things about, you know, speaking in a calm, direct manner, you know, stuff like that. Telling people to do that and actually them doing it in a stressful situation is two different things. So maybe even in GAL training, you have opportunities to role play and practice some of this. Because I can tell you, it takes me practice to stay in a playful, friendly voice in stressful situations. And to, you know, have a nice, calm face with warm eyes and all of that. That takes practice.
Yeah, this is John. Point. I would agree with that. I mean, I worked in community mental health for many years, and some of these questions and some of what we deal with in this role, there is no easy answer to how to handle that. It really depends on the child and the age. And so to expect volunteers to, you know, I think we really need to hone in on this and then get it into their training. And I do agree it would be great for them to be able to practice, because these are incredibly difficult questions to answer when you're confronted with it.
Hey guys,
and is anyone doing this already? Is anyone sort of training in this way? Okay, that's good. That's a good opportunity then for improvement. Let's. I accidentally interrupted someone, so I apologize. Go ahead, whoever started speaking.
It's Eva down in the 19th Circuit. I think it's important to remember that as attorneys, we will also need to practice those communication skills for things like child hearsay motions, which are utilized in extremely tough cases. and can really catch us off guard. I mean, it's one thing when you sit in the trainings, it's one thing when we sit here and talk about it, it's another thing when you've just looked at a horrific, heinous discovery, and then you have to sit down and talk to this little girl that it doesn't really translate in our attorney brains. How are we still not supposed to be affected, but be sensitive? It was very difficult for me this past week. So it's important not only for our guardians to be taught and practice the communication skills properly, but also for us attorneys who are going to need to utilize it in court and outside of court with our kids.
That's very, this is really good feedback, you guys. Thank you. I'm taking copious notes.
This is Lee. I had one more little quick thought. Just maybe something like a tip sheet, like what to avoid, what not to do, that kind of thing, too, I think helps GALs especially distinguish between the right, the wrong, the best, the, you know, poorest way. I mean, I don't know, just so they can start to see, you know, what the difference is, you know, sort of like to practice in that way. That might help them.
Yes, that's a good idea. And someone else was had something to add.
It's Eva. I guess it's just my day to not speak clearly. We had a trauma-based training offered in our office through our only provider that does infant mental health and trauma only for our young kids. So I'm not sure if every circuit has at least one provider that has someone, at least one individual that is a trauma-informed individual and a true trainer on it. They did offer to do our training, and our circuit director had set it up. We did one out of, I believe there's four courses so far for our entire staff to attend. And I think that might be an easy way for, as a program, us to branch out to our community partners who already have the expertise to help us in training a mass amount of people at one time.
So sort of as part of the effort to identify who is certified, once you find those people, see if they'll train. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Exactly. Sub out for some of this might be more efficient for our...
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I think I see what you're saying, Eva. That's a good idea.
And Deborah, this is Marcia again.
Yeah,
Florida has quite a few experts in this area. You know, I've just received material on a 2 or 3 day training down in Orlando. So we do have experts. It's just a matter of us identifying those and those individuals, and maybe they would be willing to do regional trainings geared for our staff and then geared for our volunteers.
Yeah, I think, go ahead.
Deborah, I just wanted to jump in real quick. There is a statewide trauma-informed care work group with probably more than 100 people on it. And there are also a lot of local trauma-informed care work groups with people with expertise in infant and early childhood mental health, you know, working with teenagers, you know, a whole bunch of different things. So that infrastructure is already in place.
Yes. And thank you, Lori. I think, you know, this is kind of a good close to the conference call because, one, there is a ton of stuff out there and there are a ton of resources. So, you know, while we've been working on our foundation and now we're going to sort of stop and pivot and figure out where we're going to go from here, I think that there is a lot of expertise in this area. It is not necessary for us to reinvent the wheel. And really the challenge is how do we pick and choose what to train on, who to train, and we need to just be cognizant of what our mission is and who we're serving so that it's very targeted. Because I know I don't have to tell all of you, you know, people don't have a ton of time. We're dealing with a volunteer population. They're sort of, you know, on the one hand, there's only so much you can do. But on the other hand, the amount of information on this topic is just tremendous. So that's going to be sort of our task as we move forward, is narrowing down specifically in a topic where really any bit of information that you give people will improve their practice. How do you select those pieces that are most important and will be most impactful to the children that we serve? So what I think is I'm going to drop back and get with Alan and maybe call a few of you individually, and we will either resume our every, you know, if we're going to have another webinar, it will probably be the third week in April, as we've been doing that third week, one afternoon, Wednesday, Thursday afternoon, if we can, or depending on the direction that Alan wants to move, we may go ahead and have another conference call. But the next thing to expect from me is an email sending the attachment that Lori prepared for us, getting some formal feedback, and maybe a possibility of, at a minimum, distributing this as a draft, you know, probably through circuit directors first. I'll talk to Frank about the process for going, for doing that. But start bringing our people sort of up to speed on what we've been doing, and not only telling them why trauma-informed care is so important to the children that they serve, but also showing them by producing tools like these and making different trainings to them available. So,
hey, Deborah, can I make a couple comments?
Ahead. Yeah.
First of all, I appreciate all you taking the time to do this. I know it takes a lot of time, but this is so important. This is the foundation of where we're headed. This is going to define our strategic plan, our standards, and how we do a really good job for kids. It seems like a lot of people that work with kids have different agendas. And, you know, the guardian ad litem historically has been the only one there that doesn't have an interest but the child. And I know the family is a critical piece of that. But how we do this work, and I know we all experience, even those that us that we think are, even those of us that are knowledgeable. I mean, I was out with an 8-year-old the other day, and I mentioned his dad was in jail. And he goes, "My dad's in jail?" And I was backpedaling. "Oh, he's not in jail for anything bad." No, I didn't say it. He was actually for child support. But, you know, it's weird. You don't think of these things because you're an adult. You're used to talking to adults. And now all of a sudden you're around a child. How are you impacting them? And how do we do this? And I've been doing this for 25 years. I've been an attorney for children and as a public defender. And I still feel like I don't know at a certain time. What do I do? We've had judges order us to not tell a child that they were their parents were TPR'd in Jacksonville, a 17-year-old kid. And the therapist said, "You cannot tell this kid this." And I'm sitting there. I thought it was the most crazy thing in the world. And, you know, the thing that sticks out to me most is, what are we telling children when we're telling them, when they don't understand some of the issues like attorney-client privilege and they're very young, and we're saying to make it explainable to them, we tell them, "Well, you can tell me a secret and I won't share it with anyone," because that's the only way they're going to understand how you tell it to them. And their abuser may have said the same thing to them. And so I think we have a long, long way to go on how we figure this out. But the people on this call right now, this is the first group that's really taken this on, and I really want to be a trauma-informed advocacy group. I don't think anyone's doing it out there. I think everyone just does it based on their own experiences, but we have experts on this phone. Some of the people on the phone have been in foster care. I consider them experts too. And together, I think we can figure this out and do a really great job for kids. And in the end, kids will have better outcomes. We won't re-traumatize them or make it worse, and hopefully make it a lot better in how we get to where we need to be. But Deborah Lacombe, thanks for being the leader of this, but there's a lot more to go. This is still just the beginning, and I appreciate everyone taking the time.
That sounds like a perfect close. Anybody who has any questions or need anything from me, please call me or email me. Thank you, Alan, and thank you, everybody on the line.